This is Wage War, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me?
This is Wade Rafferty, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice to the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World. Whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at KABF.org, WAMF.org, or AcornRadio.org. Podcasts will be available this show on these websites and at www.chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking once again to Richard Cahan, who has got another new book of interest to us called River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It, Interviews and Photographs. Rich, welcome back to Wade's World.
Thank you, Wade. I appreciate it very much.
I've done about 300 shows now. I've had so few repeat guests, but it's actually, you're on a roll now. Last time we talked about Memphis and a number of archival photographs you found that were fascinating. I tried to promote it after the show with Hook Center and said, hey, you know, there's this guy I interviewed in this book. And he said, oh, yeah, we know Rich. We know all about that book. So. But today we're talking about American slavery. Give us the background here of what got you and Michael Williams interested in going through these archives and what you have in this book.
Well, this is a book that started about two or three years ago. We were actually we were on the internet, and we were at the Library of Congress site looking at material there, and we came across the Slave Narrative Collection, which is a remarkable and visionary project. It was started in the late 1930s. The federal government, this was during the Works Progress Administration, hired a bunch of writers. They were mostly unemployed teachers and writers and newspaper people, and they sent them out to interview formerly enslaved men and women. So this is 1937. The Civil War had ended 72 years ago, so all of the people that they caught up to were in their 70s, 80s, 90s, and several of them said they were over 100 years old. And it was a simple but remarkably important project because they literally sat down with a list of questions, and they asked, basically the questions all came down to what it was like, what slavery was like. Many of the interviews, I would say most of the interviewers were white, and many of them were white women. And it was a really remarkable moment that they were being asked to come out of their homes and talk, and they were being told your ideas are very important to us. Well, there's been a bunch of books written about the Slave Narrative Collection, and they're all excellent. But what makes this book so unusual is it's based on photographs. Each of the men and women were photographed at the end, or about 350 of them, I'm sorry, were photographed at the end of their interviews. And this is a book that literally takes their portrait photographs, they're very simple but beautiful portraits, and puts their words on the facing page. So as you open up the book, you see their words and you see their photographs. And I think there's something remarkably powerful about seeing those two things paired. You see a man who remembers being given away as a wedding gift by his, quote, master as a boy, and then you look at his picture, and he's a very distinguished elderly man, probably in his 80s, posing in front of, he was actually in front of a Texas courthouse. Or you see pictures of women literally doing their wash and talking about slavery. I think that combination is very important to this book.
In the introduction, or the foreword by Adam Green, he was clear, and then you get into the stories, and they are even more powerful. This was not Happy Valley. It's worth mentioning Adam Green has a connection to Little Rock. Obviously, that's one of the stations here. His father was on the screen, who was, you know, had a noted career, Labor Department, government official, but also was one of the people who integrated Central High School, one of the...
Absolutely.
That song. So it was a pleasure to read that and then get to the end and say, oh, okay, is that who Adam Green is? He's a history professor, but he was very clear about why these stories are so important in terms of correcting, I guess, what we call false, fake news these days, that there were no good times. And I've read every one of these particular quotes that that are with the pictures that you included in the book, and not one of them claimed it was all good news.
Absolutely. I think this is a very difficult but important book to read. It is difficult for people because we really didn't hold, there were no holds barred. We didn't sweeten it, and we also didn't the quotes that we found were very representative. The people who were interviewed were so honest, and they were so they were filled with such wisdom. They oftentimes in talking about their experiences, they show so much intelligence. One person talked about how his he was surprised that the slaves were kept in relatively good condition, and he said, well, of course they were, because slaves were merchandise, and so they had to be
right. I mean, the good master, as they called them, were the ones who fed them well, understanding that they if they were fed well, they would work harder. I mean, as opposed to some of them that were just venal. But no, you're exactly right. There was some real political analysis. I wrote down one quote from William Hamilton, who was one of the many people in the book. They has the power, and it am done for to show they has the power. You could put that, take that out of the dialect and put that in almost any sentence, and it's as true today as it was almost 100 years ago. 80 years ago, when some of these interviews were being conducted, we still have a lot of people trying to show people that they have the power, and that was clearly part of what prevailed, good or bad masters and mistresses, for many of these slave narratives, wasn't it?
I agree. Yes, it was, and I think that listeners should know that it's not just kind of a random collection of stories. We very carefully took these stories and created an arc, so that the book starts with formerly enslaved men and women talking about their identity. A woman says, I don't know exactly where I was born, and I don't know exactly when I was born. And then there's a chapter of day-to-day life, and a chapter on violence, and a chapter on the Civil War and the end of the war and Reconstruction. And then it ends really with them looking back at these years. And I guess what I was struck by two things. I was struck by the wisdom, which I mentioned, how clear people were in remembering these things so far back. I don't know if I was 75 or 80, if I would remember my childhood as well, and the very, very specific details about being woken up in the morning by the sound of the horn and by or the bell, and working every single day, but getting off on Sundays. But those details were amazing to me. And then I think I was really moved by these pictures. I think that people should understand that these pictures were not taken by professional photographers, but they were simply taken by the people who interviewed the former men, the men and women. And they're not professional. They were usually done with kind of a Brownie camera. But what they lack in professionalism, they make up in their authenticity. You know, these are people who for one moment are going to be remembered in history, and they're so proud, even though one man literally has a rope holding his pants up, and you see them leaning back in rocking chairs and being photographed in their cornfields. And, you know, it's kind of like when you look back at your childhood pictures, maybe your family went to a professional photographer, and that's fine, but it's the family snapshots, the little snapshots of children that are much more indicative, not much more honest about what life was like.
Well, and, you know, for those people who we hope take a look at this book, I mean, a huge majority of the pictures are taken in settings that obviously indicate that 60, 70 years later, these former slaves are a long way from doing well.
Very hard life.
You know, these are hard luck pictures still. These are, you know, broken steps, and they're still working hard at their age, and you're looking at things that look hardly better than the shacks they had on a plantation. And a huge number of them, and it speaks to a difference in, to some degree, in modern life and 80 years ago, were living with remaining relatives, children, grandchildren, nieces, because obviously they didn't have retirement money.
Right.
We were just talking about the onset of Social Security. These were people who'd worked hard all their lives, went from slavery to, you know, farming, cow punching, being laundry workers, whatever, cooks and bartenders and whatever. Nobody in these interviews had hit the big time.
Absolutely not. I'm so happy you mentioned that, because each person, there is a very short paragraph that talks about what had happened in their lives, and it's exactly that. These were people. Most of these people had not gotten very far off of the original plantation, and the reason is, of course, they had no mobility, they had very little money, they were given so little during their times in bondage of learning how to read and write and handle money that obviously life was going to be very stacked against them.
Well, and a lot of these interviews, and the introduction goes through this, we're talking to Rich Gahan about his new book, along with Michael Williams, called River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It, based on slave narratives. But a lot of these interviews were in Texas. You'd have people who started out in Alabama or Georgia or whatever, and clearly as the Civil War came along, their masters either sold them or moved them, sort of escaping the tide to Texas to try to hold on. But as I read the history of the actual WPA interviews, number 3,000 of them, a lot of them took place in Texas.
They did. And that was something, I have to be frank, it was a little bit new to me. I didn't understand the second migration, which was exactly the way you described it. As the Civil War approached, or as the Civil War started, a lot of slaveholders in Georgia and Alabama and obviously North Carolina and South Carolina started moving to south and west to stay away from the Civil War.
And I had, I mean, that was what struck me as well, Rich. I had not fully focused on that, but it was, you know, it was inescapable as you read every one of the reports, because so many of them
right.
ended up in Texas and, you know, they'd sort of hopscotched around the South, being sold or their owners had moved or run. And a lot of them then ended up staying in Texas once it was all done, too.
Exactly. Wade, I'm interested in what else you learned from the book. What value you saw of the book?
Well, I mean, you know, you end up making interesting notes. I've read a lot of books about the Ku Klux Klan, but I never, you know, knew the expression "white cap" so well.
Right.
I was interested in the. I learned some language, and I was going to test you. I mean, one of them I could still not figure out. What is a paddy wilbur? Do you know?
Oh, sure, I do.
Good.
Paddy.
That one stumped me.
Oh, well, paddy rollers were white vigilantes who roamed the South, and if an enslaved person escaped, they would grab them and bring them back. But it wasn't even just escaping. If a former slave was visiting a cousin at another plantation, they would have to have a pass. And unless they had the pass, they would be treated really violently by the paddy rollers. So they got paid by the...
No, I knew that's what the job was, but where does that word paddy roller come from?
You know, I don't know.
That's what I was curious about.
Yeah,
I kept thinking,
right.
Paddies? I mean, are these people that... like sausage a certain way. I mean, just
yeah.
they were slave runners for sure, and that's because some of the other words you asked me what I learned. I wrote down devilment, picklement, worryment.
Right. Right.
There's a lot of ways that people constructed nouns there that were even more powerful. I mean, being in a picklement to me seems a lot worse than being in a pickle. You know, being in a devilment, I mean, I understood that fully. I mean, these are words that we need to resurrect from those days. But
I agree with you. That was a big decision because many of the interviews were the interviewers transcribed what was considered the black dialect of the South, and it is difficult. It's almost like when you're reading Huckleberry Finn at first, you have problems with it in high school. But then, as you say, there's a great beauty to the language and, a great expression to the language, and I wanted to keep that. And we do have a glossary. I don't know if you saw this, Wade, but we do have a glossary.
I did, when I finally got to the end. By then, right. I'd figured out almost all of them. Well, I had, except, you know, obviously I'm going to have to do some. I didn't have time when I finished the book to do the research on where the etymology of patty roller is, but I want to know, because that's some evil. But I just found some of the expressions so powerful. I mean, there was another one by George Young who said, Missy, obviously being interviewed by a young woman, Missy, where was the Lord in them days? Where was he doing? Which, and in the book you have it, there's obviously a difference plantation to plantation, whether or not religion was encouraged or discouraged,
right?
In terms of whether it kept the peace and interfered with the work. So, I mean, George Young had it right about where was the Lord during those times. I mean, slavery is such an abomination, but people spoke powerfully.
Absolutely, and it's a question, obviously, that was on people's lips at the end of the Holocaust, and it's such an important question. It's so profound. That he talked about that. I'm so happy you mentioned that. The other thing that I think that I learned from this whole experience is I was always taught about slavery, in kind of political terms, the North against the South, and or mercantile economic terms, you know, the cotton and all that. And what gets lost is the human lives that, you know, the human terms, and that's what I thought. Think that the collection does the very best.
Well, and I have to ask you to tell the story that y'all picked up this phrase "River of Blood" from one of the lines that one of the former slaves expressed.
Right.
Tell people about that because it's so. We know it all from Django and whatever, but terrible story. Why don't you share it with us?
It is. Well, we used that term. We were most interested in that term because so many of the formerly enslaved men and women talked about blood. It just seemed to be something that kept on coming up. And Lou Williams, whose quote it was from, talks about just remembering that during a beating, that there was blood everywhere, a river of blood, and it was so. You know, like you say, we've seen it in Hollywood dramatizations, but to actually hear someone remember it so many years later, and that we thought that was important and eloquent, and that's why we named the book "River of Blood."
Well, and that's the most difficult section of the book to read because it's one story after another of terrible beatings, terrible descriptions, graphic descriptions of how not only were slaves, you know, whipped for, you know, in some cases, just out of meanness, not for any reason or rationale whatsoever, but other slaves, in some cases, five other slaves were essentially forced to abet that, each holding the leg or an arm or even the head while somebody was whipped until the blood came out. And that was not just men. That was women and men. It didn't matter. And then in some cases, you know, the extremes people went to, heating grease to put in the wound, salt, vinegar. I mean, what kind of, I use the word abomination already, but, 100 years, 150 years later, how did we ever, you know, sort of get away from that cloud? I mean, you can't. For those of you who I encourage to take a look at this book and the pictures that come with it, it's very difficult to believe that we are past the shadow.
Yes, it is. And I think that one thing that came clear to me, and perhaps it should have come clear, you know, years ago, was that slavery was all based on terrorism. And that terrorism was something that wasn't just individual. It had to be public so that everybody saw the whippings and everybody saw the grease, because the slaveholders thought that that would be more effective. And there was obviously, you know, now in theory in life, we understand that it's the carrot that makes people work harder. But there was no carrots in slavery. It was all sticks. And that was, but I think even in this moment of, violence, there's a great humanity that rises up in each story.
No, I mean, certainly we were talking about people who didn't want to look back or look back, you know, no matter how hard people had it when they were interviewed, they were always clear freedom was better. And that's, you know, that's helpful. We're talking to Rich Gahan, and who, along with Michael Williams, has edited a book called River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It. There's another section, Sarah Graves had a quote there, which, you know, told about where the expression "sold down the river" came from. And one of our stations is in New Orleans, is where I'm based. But it came from the fact that if you were up the Mississippi River, too often you were gathered by enslavers, bought, you know, 50 and 100 at a time, put on a boat and sent down the river, sold down the river, as the expression goes, to New Orleans, to a slave market there. And then she added, and one of the most powerful expressions I've ever heard of our economic reality here in this country, times don't change, just the merchandise. Wow. I mean, that says a lot right there, doesn't it, Rich? Gee, Manny.
It does. It does. There's this feeling, I think, people don't know if people who were born into slavery really understood the full impact of it. And obviously, from every one of these interviews, everyone knew what was going on. And, but they were unable to do much about it. But they did do some. You know, there's a tremendous amount of stories of resistance. Obviously, people who escaped and went north, but also stories of kind of not so silent resistance. People who took it to the fields and, you know, found songs to the Lord, and people who, there was this story about this one man who, as he was being beaten, refused to cry out, refused to acknowledge what was going on. And I think that's a remarkable part of this whole question.
Until they almost killed him, in which case he said, you know, he had to say what he had to say. One of the figures that comes out in the book is the estimate of that perhaps of all the millions that were enslaved, 100,000 may have been able to escape over time, but that's a success story, not the attempts.
Right.
Because clearly many of these whippings, and the whippings were ubiquitous plantation to plantation, were based on many people trying to escape. And that's certainly covered by the histories that Genovese and the great historian of slavery has written as well. What are your hopes for people getting a look at this book? Because this is... it's powerful, it's difficult, but, you know, it takes away the whitewash. I mean, even the Ku Klux Klan, I mean, the sections about the Reconstruction and the daily terror that people had from the Klan trying to take away what freedom they had.
This is not both of the nation. Obviously, reconciliation is the ultimate goal for me, and frankly, for the country. We need to reconciliate what went on in the 1800s. This book isn't going that far. This book is really, really hoping that people understand more. They understand what was going on, and that's obviously the first step towards reconciliation.
There's no question about that. There was sort of, you know, in terms of religion, there was someone who still believed that a rabbit's foot may have saved them.
Right.
But that was a long story about voodoo that was sort of interesting. It gave you a sense of some of the other side, but that was only one person's comments. So I don't know how common it really was, but
You know, it was common. It was common, and we didn't put enough. Perhaps we didn't put enough of that in because voodoo was. You had to look for anything, you know, as when you were in bondage, and voodoo was just part of it. You know, rabbit's foot, whatever could help you, was something that you wanted.
One of the things you mentioned is that of all the 5,000 writers and interviewers on the WPA project, only 100 of them were African Americans themselves.
Right.
How do you think these stories might have been received or documented differently had it been more a question of African Americans interviewing former slaves? I wonder about that.
It's hard to know, but I will say that it seems like people were incredibly candid with what they said. And so
yes,
I think that, you know, so I don't know. Adam Green, who you mentioned wrote the foreword, said that the whole process was, he said, vexed and compromised because of that. But he also said it was revelatory. You know, we really learn a tremendous amount about slavery through these government processes.
Well, and I think we learn things that people don't want to really still accept as part of what is in our history. You know, we have modern day debates about reparations and this, that, and the other. We're not in any risk in the current political climate of that being taken too seriously, but there's no question that, organizing against redlining and racial discrimination in neighborhoods and the impact on wealth for African-American families compared to white families, where the wealth of the average African-American family is still hardly over zero, where it's 100,000 or more for others. I mean, these things still, the impact of the Ku Klux Klan, Reconstruction, the taking away of rights, that's still not exactly repaired. There was no 40 acres and a mule. That was a promise that disappeared immediately.
Right, and I think that anyone who reads this book will understand that it literally is two histories, you know, African American history and white history, and that people have to take that into account, because everything in this book harkens to today. A man who talks about how he was picked up for vagrancy because he was on the street and he was put into a chain gang for 6 months. This is continued. You see so many connections to today. This isn't just a history book. It's a book that I think really relates to us today in 2020.
Well, and it's just the treating of people like they were cattle, like they were domestic animals. The one woman who talks about her father and starts going through, you know, she was one of 12 by her mother, and then, you know, her father had 50 or more children because he was seen as a breeder. You know, it was like he was a bull stud out there on the cattle ranch or on the farm, not a person at all.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just so horrific. But this is not one you read, you know, this is not a book you leave out there for your children until they get to the age where they're ready. But it is a book that people really need to read. Rich, how do people get a copy of River of Blood? Is it out now?
It is out now. I hope they can find it at bookstores. They certainly could, you know, order it at any bookstore, but it should be in most bookstores. And you can buy it on Amazon, something that I think is easy, or they can come to our website, which is City Files Press, just CityFilesPress.com, City Files Press, and they can learn more about the book, and they can buy it directly from us.
And this publisher is out of Chicago, huh? Okay.
I live in Evanston, a suburb of Chicago, where we are really we've taken our new marijuana tax, and we are really trying to figure out how to correct the inequities, the racial inequities in Evanston, and I think we're making progress here.
Well, certainly I know exactly where Evanston was, and this Your work was also supported by a grant. Was that Jonathan Logan? I can't even read in my...
Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, which has given us grants to do work like this. They're a great foundation that really believes in working towards social justice.
Exactly right. So this is, once again, is there a website? Give that website again, Rich.
There is. It's cityfilespress.com. CityFiles press.com. I think if people write my name, which is Rich Cahan, CAHAN, and River of Blood, they'll also find it easily.
Well, it's been Second Signs of Charm. I'm sure the next time you have a book, you'll know how to find me as well. But this is a powerful book. I couldn't recommend it more. This has been Wage World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard. And as Lucinda Williams sings, things you've never seen and will never forget. Wage World is underwritten by the Darrow Foundation, a progressive force enabling change based in Little Rock, Arkansas. And as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wage World. Thank you.